Thousands of Iranians attending their team's first match of the World Cup use it as a platform to support protests in Iran against Islamist rule. A VOA Persian reporter who is at the stadium tells us what those Iranians plan to do next after watching Iran lose to England in Qatar.
I talked to many of them. They promised to be at the Ahmed bin Ali Stadium on Friday before the Iran-Wales match.
Plus, we'll look at why the U.S. is sanctioning Iranian state TV's top personalities. And later in the show, a U.S. arms control expert tells us how Iran secured Western parts for attack drones used in Russia's war on Ukraine.
Their strategy is pretty simple. I mean, these are not high-tech components, and so they essentially just buy them off the shelf wherever they can find these items being sold.
From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. The Iranian men's football team suffered a 6-2 defeat to England in their World Cup opener in Qatar on Monday, one of Iran's worst ever losses. The reaction from Iranians at the stadium was mixed. Some were hugely disappointed, but others were defiant. They chanted "Death to Khamenei," Iran's supreme leader, echoing the calls of many protesters who have been joining nationwide demonstrations for the past 2 months to call for an end to his Islamist rule. The Iranian team's Portuguese coach Carlos Queiroz told a post-match news conference that issues surrounding the protests were hurting his players' concentration.
Of course, all the Iranians in the stadium, they are welcome. They have the right to be pleased or even to criticize the team. That's not the problem. But those that they come to disturb the team with the issues that are not only about the football opinions, they're not welcome.
VOA Persian reporter Ali Ahmadi was at Doha's Khalifa International Stadium for the Iran-England match. I asked him what was behind those mixed reactions from the Iranians who were there.
The stadium was 45,300 people, spectators. And I have to say half of them were Iranian. And Iranian were two parts. Some part were state-sponsored fans. I can say definitely they were not a typical fan. They were the militia of different organization in Iran, got the free ticket and traveled to Qatar, which is really close to Iran. And those people were, of course, chanting for Iran win and waving the Iran flag. Islamic Republic flag, and they were obviously were pro-regime, pro-team. And half of the Iranian, as you might know, Qatar government and FIFA did not allow anyone to bring old Iranian flag or anything from Mahsa Amini or anything that says women's life freedom. So those people who decided to come to the stadium and be the voice of Iranian protesters, they will come, and they promised, I talked to many of them, they promised to be at the Ahmed bin Ali Stadium on Friday before the Iran-Wales match. So they don't accept this statement. They don't accept this demand, which Carlos Queiroz is saying after they lose. They will say that you do not support the Iranian fan and the team players. They just silence during the anthem. And Iranian protesters believed that was not enough. They had to show more solidarity. They had to show more respect to Iranian. And they could kneel like the England national team did. They could kneel. They could celebrate differently when they scored 2 goals by Mehdi Taremi. They believed that they could have a wristband, black wristband, and show their solidarity more loudly and firm and clearly, but they didn't. And they were not satisfied at all. So they decide to come back to the stadium this time, 2 hours ahead of the game, gathering outside the stadium and do as much as they can be loud and use the international media here as a vessel to be voice of the Iranian people.
For those fans, did it really matter what the score was, or were they just more interested in communicating their message, you know, to people inside Iran and to the world?
They were two different type of fans. Some of them were really soccer fans, but hoping better solidarity and support from Iran national team. I'm 100%, if Iran national team were doing something really firmly and clearly supporting Iranian people and doing something that are against this massacre that's happened right now in Iran, of course they were supporting the national team and chanting for win. But it didn't happen, so they were at the end were really happy to see Iran losing. But there were some supporter or trying to be voice of the Iranian people. They came here only and just for being the voice of Iranian people. I mean, I talked to many of them. They said they're here. They traveled all the way from Canada, from US, from Spain. A lady I just talked to, she said, we are here only for this reason, to be voice of all silenced girls being killed in Iran. So they didn't care about the result. And actually, they were so happy to see this team is losing. And they were saying that this is karma. You don't support Iranian, you turn back to Iranian people. So that's you get it. You know, the keeper had a collision and his nose was broken. And they were so happy because they were seeing photos that he is bowing in front of the Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, who is responsible for a lot of massacre killing in during the 80s and now.
You're referring to when the goalkeeper and the rest of the team met with the Iranian president before traveling to Qatar for the World Cup. What I wanted to ask is, actually, did any of these different groups of Iranians, did they mix? Did you have Iranian fans who were part of the government sort of pro-Iran team group? Did they interact with those who came to basically protest?
I mean, to be honest with you, majority of Iranian fans, they were Iran state-sponsored fans with the Iran current flag. But maybe out of 20,000 Iranian fans, maybe only 5,000 people were trying to be the voice of Iranian. And more Iranian state-sponsored fans with the free ticket, they were, of course, not really happy to see Iran losing so badly. So they know that Iran not just lose the game, lost the support of Iranian people as well. They are aware of this, but they try to ignore this, you know, as usual.
VOA Persian's Ali Ahmadi reporting from the World Cup in Qatar on Iran versus England. Thank you very much for being on Flashpoint Iran.
Sure, thank you.
The World Cup has not stopped Iran's Islamist rulers from using harsher methods to suppress the mostly peaceful nationwide protests that began in mid-September. London-based rights group Amnesty International says Iranian security forces have intensified their use of live ammunition to disperse protests in provinces populated by Kurds and other oppressed ethnic minorities since November 15th. Iran's judiciary also sentenced to death five unnamed protesters earlier this month in what rights activists said was an attempt to once again scare the Iranian public into fearing the authorities. Amnesty International responded by calling on governments with embassies in Iran to send observers to the trials of those and other detained protesters facing potential death sentences. Raha Bahraini is an Iran researcher for the group. I asked her whether Iran has allowed such observers in the past.
There is no precedent that we are aware of that Iran has allowed observers attending such trials. This is a request that we are going to increasingly make, asking governments with embassies in Iran to request that that independent observers attend the trials. In practice, we don't expect that the authorities would allow that happening. However, we think that by making this request, there will be extra pressure on the authorities authorities, and they will register that the international community is watching their practices around the use of the death penalty in connection with the protests. Moreover, the authorities have claimed that these trials are public, and by not allowing observers to attend the trials, they actually prove that they are not being truthful and the trials are not public.
That was Amnesty International's Raha Bahraini. Visit voanews.com and click the Iran tab at the top of the page for updates on Iran throughout the day. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. The Biden administration is taking new action against one of the Iranian government's main tools to suppress dissent. On November 16th, the U.S. Treasury Department sanctioned six personnel with Iran's state TV network IRIB, whom it said are engaged in interrogations of dissidents and censorship of anti-government protests. Gulnaz Esfandiari is a correspondent for VOA's sister network, RFERL. She spoke to me about the most notable IRIB staffers targeted by the U.S. sanctions.
Two of the people who were sanctioned by the United States, who are being referred to as journalist interrogators, these two have been accused of being involved and participating in a process of getting people to confess. One of them is Amene Saadat Zabihpour, a woman. She's been, for example, accused by a labor activist, Sepide Golyan, of having been involved in her interrogation, in her confession, that was later used in a show and aired by the state TV. And, you know, these shows, these confessions are used to discredit activists, to discredit dissidents, and to create fear in the society. And people are subjected to hours and hours of interrogation. They're mentally tortured, and they have no contact with the outside world. So these confessions are extracted under very difficult situations for these prisoners.
What can you say about the effectiveness of this tactic by the Iranian government to try to get forced confessions onto their programs? I mean, do these actually work in terms of the impact they have on the public?
You know, I would say that among a large segment of the society, people who are the young people, people who are very well connected, it actually creates a backlash. For example, when the second journalist interrogator who has been sanctioned by the U.S., Ali Rezvani, he interviewed journalist Ruhollah Zam, who was later executed by Iran. And, you know, everyone, what people remember from that interview is just a few seconds where Zam actually challenged Ali Rezvani, because Rezvani was referring to the protests, to the 2019 protest in Iran, as riots. And Zam told him, "You call them riots, we call them protests." And this is what has been remembered from that interview. And of course, people, you know, they criticized Rezvani for doing that, because it was a kind of torture, and rightly so. The Reporters Without Borders, which is based in Paris, issued a statement then and said this, you know, that this was torture, because Ruhollah Islam was in prison. He was held in solitary confinement, and they forced him to do this interview, which wasn't a real interview. But the regime still uses it, use this tactics.
Why do you think they still use it?
I think they, among their own supporters, they think that this is, you know, aimed at them, that they believe the regime and they believe whatever they air, and this is what they're doing. But as I said, lots of people don't trust the state TV, and they don't watch it. And especially during these days when we're seeing protests in Iran, several state TV reporters have resigned, and one commentator yesterday appeared on state TV wearing a black shirt, and he said, you know, this is the last time I'm coming, because I care about my people, and I'm not going to speak to state TV anymore. And this is because of what the state TV has done, because of censorship, because of state disinformation, and because, you know, they're basically a tool of state repression. And these journalist interrogators who were sanctioned by the U.S. are also being used as tools in the state repression and disinformation efforts.
Well, you mentioned just now that some IRIB staff have been, in a way, staging their own acts of protest. Are we starting to see a bit of a revolt in this network? What is your sense?
I would be cautious. I don't think it's a revolt yet. But as I said, there were two or three people who said they're resigning, that they don't want to work with the state TV anymore. So I think we have to wait and see if you know, this will turn into a larger protest, if there are more and more people coming out and criticizing the state TV and saying that they're not ready to work with it anymore. And there was another, a very prominent moderator who used to work for the state TV. They apparently had invited him and said to comment the Qatar, the World Cup, and the national teams competitions. And he refused to do so. And he said, no, I'm going to stand with my own people, and I'm not going to work with you.
Just to wrap up here, what kind of impact do you think these U.S. sanctions might have on the individuals who are sanctioned and IRIB as a whole? Or is it more kind of symbolic, do you think?
I believe that these sanctions have a more symbolic value, as you said. I don't think any of these individuals were planning to travel to the U.S. You know, maybe they do, we don't know. But if they were hoping that they would travel to the U.S. or when they move to the U.S., they're not going to be able to do that. But it definitely has a symbolic value, because it sends the message that the U.S. is, you know, is standing with the protesters, and they're condemning the state repression, and they're condemning the action by these so-called journalists.
Well, Gulnaz Esfandiari, correspondent for RFERL, speaking to us from Prague, thank you so much for joining us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thanks for having me.
U.S. media have reported that Iran has reached an agreement to produce more attack drones for Russia's war against Ukraine by building those drones inside Russia. Those reports cited intelligence assessments of Western security agencies. Iran has acknowledged sending a small number of drones to Russia before its full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February. But the U.S. says Tehran more recently sent hundreds of the weapons to Moscow, which used them to carry out deadly strikes on Ukrainian targets. U.S. researchers also have learned that some parts of those Iranian drones were made by Western companies. I spoke to one of those researchers, David Albright, of the Institute for Science and International Security, and asked him how Iran was able to get those parts.
Well, their strategy is pretty simple. I mean, these are not high-tech components, and so they essentially just buy them off the shelf wherever they can find these items being sold. It could be directly from the company, could be from distributors, it could be a, you know, distributor located in a distant country from the supplier. So they'll use as many techniques as they need to get them. They have been detected doing this in the past. I mean, there were German engines ending up in Iranian drones, and those were the German government said it was illegal to do that and pursued the company. But it was illegal not in the sense because of export controls on a particular good, but just that where they ended up, namely in Iranian drones. And I think in this case, they were actually used in Yemen.
How much do the European companies and other Western companies whose parts are ending up in these drones, how much do they know about the end use of these items?
I think they know more than they're letting on. I mean, if you took an electronic component that's commonly sold, I mean, of course, that company probably doesn't know. But when you have these aircraft engines, I think they would have a sense of who's buying them. And we know in the German case, with the German company, they clearly knew because the German government came after them. And we think they were involved, or at least knew of a case of sort of letting a Chinese company take over manufacture of the engines and create an identical engine that then Iran could buy. And so we don't quite understand all the linkage between the original company and the Chinese company, but it's the same motor being sold. So it's very suspicious. So I think they know, but they felt that they're dealing with kind of parts that shouldn't be controlled in any way, regardless of their use. But now it's times have changed.
How are you and your colleagues able to track down the sources of components that have been found in the wreckage of these drones?
Yeah, it's from looking at photos and videos of the drones provided by the Ukrainians, principally, and many of them are public. And you can analyze the components. Maybe you can sometimes see, you know, like the name of an Austrian motor company in one of the drones. You can also look at part numbers, and often part numbers, believe it or not, are the string is unique, and you can then identify it to a company. Sometimes there'll be another kind of marking on the part that'll allow you to tie it to a company. And we also, these drones are used around the Middle East. We have images from the Kurdish people or the Kurdish command of drones that were used against them. And then you can see parts and identify. And there you could see parts from two additional U.S. companies. We haven't made that public for the reason that we'd like the U.S. government to investigate it.
What do you know about efforts by the U.S. and its allies to stop this procurement process? You mentioned Germany might tell a company to cease and desist, but what are they actually doing right now, as far as you know?
Well, they in the past, they haven't been doing enough. And when the U.S. government focuses on a problem like this, they can visit the company, parts of the government can get the export records of the company without even a search warrant, just like they can search your luggage at the border, same government, right? And they can seek the cooperation of the company to understand their distribution networks. They can start setting up sting operations to try to figure out how to bust the people who buy these parts. So even though they're not controlled, they're widely used, the U.S. government can do pretty good job of trying to rip out the supply chain root and branch. And in this case, they'll have cooperation with the Europeans from some Asian countries. So I think they can do quite a bit. And certainly the main suppliers in the United States and Europe have gotten the word that you're complicit in killing innocent Ukrainians. So you better stop, because now your parts are being broadcast all over the print media and TV.
Well, the U.S. did actually impose some sanctions on several companies in the last few days in Iran and in the UAE for delivering drones to Russia. How effective are sanctions like that, and should more be done in other aspects?
I mean, those kind of sanctions are useful, and they set up a baseline of what's appropriate and or legal. But it's not enough. And this trying to go after the supply chain and rip it out root and branch is far more powerful and important to do. And at the same time, you know, if you get companies' cooperation and you somehow put a clandestine geolocator someplace in that part, I don't want to go into the details, but it sure would be nice if a drone ended up in Ukraine that came from Iran, and the geolocator could be turned on, and Ukraine could then attack the storage sites of these drones. I mean, this is a little fanciful, but these are the kind of possibilities that open up once the U.S. government and its allies start to really focus on understanding and then disrupting the supply chain of drone parts.
Well, David Albright, president of the Institute for Science and International Security, speaking to us from the Washington, D.C. area. Thanks so much for being on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Voice of America's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Glad you could join me, and I hope you'll do the same next week.